As the new year approaches, many people start reflecting on the year that has passed and start thinking about how they want the next year to be. Imagine if in 2022 you were able to have clarity on what matters to you and then have the tools to live that out. Imagine if you were able to be the person you really want to be. That's where I come in. I've helped hundreds of people from around the world become who they deeply want to be. If you're feeling frustrated or disappointed in your ability to make changes in your life, then having someone in your corner to support and advise you is critical. Look, there's a lot of general advice out there, but figuring out which of it applies to you is difficult. You are different than other people, and your life looks different than other people, so you need solutions that make sense for you. Knowing how to apply certain tactics and tools to your specific life is my specialty. If you'd like to make 2022 a better year for you, then book a 30-minute discovery call with me. It's a no-pressure, no-sales call where we determine if working together might make sense. And if it doesn't, I'll give you some ideas to take with you so you win either way. Go to oneyoufeed.net/coaching to book your free discovery session. That's oneyoufeed.net/coaching to book a free discovery session, and I look forward to meeting you.
You take all of your energies and you try to put walls up around yourself such that nothing bad can get to you. Ironically, the one thing that truly won't get to you is happiness.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest on this episode is Arthur Brooks, a best-selling author, social scientist, and the president of the American Enterprise Institute. He teaches leadership and happiness at the Harvard School of Business. And today, Arthur and Eric discuss one of his many books, Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt.
Hi, Arthur. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
I'm happy to have you on. We're going to be discussing your latest book, Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. And we're also going to be talking about happiness, which is a topic you have written a lot about. But before we get into either of those things, we'll start like we always do with the parable. In the parable, there's a grandfather who's talking with his grandson. He says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love. And the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandson stops and he thinks about it for a second and he looks up at his grandfather and he says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work that you do.
Well, I appreciate that. And I've heard you talk about this in the past and talk about it with your guests. And so I've given it a little bit of thought because this is actually what I teach. At the Harvard Business School, I have a class called Leadership and Happiness, and this is almost exactly what I ask my students to do. You know, what are they feeding? Which wolf are they feeding? And for me, it comes down to literally one of the choices that you gave. It's love or fear. This is what we've got, love or fear. And on my worst days, I realize that I'm feeding fear. I am afraid of what people will think about me. I'm afraid of what's going to happen to me. And fear is sort of the shadow of the dark one over what we're doing in our lives. And there's an antidote to it, which of course is, as you'd say, feeding the other wolf. But there's a way to do it too. In the Bible, St. John the Apostle says that perfect love drives out fear. But this is an ancient idea. 500 years before that, Lao Tzu said in the Tao Te Ching exactly the same thing, that the psychological opposites, not just philosophical and theological opposites, psychological opposites are fear and love. When you stimulate the limbic system of the brain to experience love, it will literally crowd out, because you can't be experiencing these two cognitions simultaneously, the fear that is in you. So what I try to do each day is I say, look, what's animating me today? What's animating me? And if it's fear, I know the answer to it. I got to get out the sack of wolf chow and start throwing it on the love side. That's what I have to do. And that's what I'm trying to do every single day. That's a more robust answer than you probably wanted, Eric. Sorry about that.
I like robust. So what are some of your ways of getting out the love wolf chow in your own life?
So probably the most really profound psychological teaching from medieval times, from the Middle Ages, comes from St. Thomas Aquinas, when he wrote his Summa Theologia, that had this really interesting and insightful observation that we have these substitutes for divinity in our lives, these idols that have these kind of divine characteristics, but they never give us what we really seek. They're money, power, pleasure, and honor, or fame. Money, power, pleasure, and fame. And the problem is that when you're pursuing those things, you're always going to be living in fear. Now, you're living in fear. Why? Because these are zero-sum things. These are extrinsic things, which is to say that they come from outside you and you can't depend on them. And so you're always going to be afraid that you're not going to get this thing. If you say, basically, I'm going to be nourished by the scraps the world is promising it will throw to me, then I'm going to be living in a fear-based world. And the answer then is, if those are the bad four, money, power, pleasure, and fame, there's a good four. There's a divine four, which are not extrinsic from outside you, but from inside you. And they're based not on fear, but on love. And they are faith and family and friendship and work that serves other people. Those are the divine four. And there's 10,000 articles on the social science of happiness and the science and neuroscience and social science of happiness. And if you boil the ocean of this literature, you will find that there are really only four things that reliably do bring happiness. They are faith, family, friendship, and work, where you serve other people and you earn your success. And these are the antidotes to the bad fear four. I mean, if the bad wolf, the fear wolf, is just chowing down on money and power and pleasure and fame and all the stuff that's scarce and you're worried it's going to go away. And if you want to feed the other wolf, you need to put a deposit in each one of the four divine accounts every day. What are you doing to cultivate your faith? What are you doing to develop your family and maintain and protect your family relationships? Thanksgiving's coming, man. What are you doing with your friendships? And what are you doing such that your work truly is lifting other people up? Those are the questions to ask. And I try to ask myself every day.
So faith, family, friendships, and work that matters.
Yeah, that's a meaningful work. A meaningful work only has two characteristics. They are not prestige and position and money, none of that stuff's on the list. The two things that matter to make your work meaningful are the answers to the questions, am I earning my success and am I serving others?
Am I earning my success and am I serving others? There's a lot of things that people would say are parts of the good life that maybe aren't clearly delineated in these. Where does pleasure fit in this? Some degree of enjoyment. Because I think you also mentioned that if we talk about happiness, you talk about it having three sort of macronutrients,
right,
which are enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose. There's some crossover here, and then there's a little, perhaps some slight differences. I'm curious how those tie together for you.
Sure. So happiness is like a meal. And there's lots of ways. If I said, Eric, what's dinner? Well, it's like, what kind of question is that? There's a bunch of ways that I can answer the question, what's dinner? I can answer in terms of dinner's macronutrients, which are protein, carbohydrates, and fat. I could answer dinner is the dishes that I had. I had a salad, and I had an entree, and I had some dessert. I had my vegetables. Or you could answer it in terms of the micronutrients that was in it. You know, all the different parts, the vitamins and minerals that actually go into it. Mm-hmm. There's lots and lots of ways to answer the question. Or the ingredients, you know, the spices and the actual foods that you cooked. So the way to think about it is this way. When I said faith, family, friends, and meaningful work, those are the dishes in your happiness. Those are the things you actually need to consume every day.
Well, let's dig a little further into the purpose or meaning side of things. You recently talked about different ways or the different parts of meaning. Should we go into that for a second?
Yeah, sure. So meaning and purpose or purpose is another way of talking about it, although purpose is actually an aspect of meaning. Meaning is definitely one of the macronutrients of happiness, and it's actually one of the most paradoxical insofar as that, you know, there's nobody listening to us. Or when I said, when did you figure out the meaning of your life? What was a significant event helping you figure out the meaning of your life? There's nobody that would talk about that week in Disneyland. They would always talk about something hard that had happened, something trying, taxing, maybe even traumatic, the death of a loved one, when I got really sick, when I lost my job, and I was able to persevere. I actually found that I was strong and I was resilient. That's when I figured out what I really cared about, is when things were threatened for me. And so that's an important point, is that meaning requires challenge and difficulty, problems, even trauma, which actually brings out sadness and makes you unhappy. And so the great irony of happiness is that happiness requires meaning, and meaning is associated with unhappiness. And so literally, happiness requires unhappiness. And one of the biggest mistakes that we make in our lives today is that we spend a huge amount of our energy trying to avoid unhappiness. We go to huge lengths. I mean, I talk to my students about this all the time. I have graduate students here at Harvard, and they spend a ton of their time trying not to feel sad, not to be rejected, not to take risk, not to get in trouble. And, you know, it's like, don't go looking for trouble, but trust me, trouble's going to find you, man. I mean, this is just life. And if you take all of your energies and you try to put walls up around yourself such that nothing bad can get to you, ironically, the one thing that truly won't get to you is happiness, because you won't actually find meaning. You won't find out who you are, and you'll be afraid, and that fear will be coming in instead of the love. You'll be feeding the fear wolf by doing this. This is exactly what we're doing to a lot of young people. So we talk about, you know, safetyism and cancel culture and all these things that we complain about in our society today. It has everything to do with fear, and it has to do with the fact that we have a society that says, like, whereas in the 60s, they said, if it feels good, do it, man. Today, they're like, if it feels bad, stop it. If it feels bad, treat it. If it feels bad, anesthetize it, make it go away. And that's a huge, huge mistake. So that's a preamble to the entire meaning lesson, the meaning macronutrients in our happiness. If you want to be happy, you need meaning. If you're going to have meaning, you have to be open to all types of experiences in life. Don't be afraid of pain. I mean, it's not going to be fun, but you need it. And it will ultimately, in the vast overwhelming majority of cases, you will get growth as a result of it.
Yeah, it is paradoxical in that way. And yet we're so wired up that the natural tendency within us is to avoid pain, seek pleasure.
Yeah, totally. And to seek pleasure, or just to seek peace, to seek a lack of problems.
Yep.
And it's an error. It's just an error. There's no other way to put it. Now, when you get into meaning itself, meaning actually has three parts to it. So when people say to me, I don't know my meaning in life, what that really means is they have one of, or more of, three problems. That we call these the meanings of meaning, as it were, you know, the aspects of meaning: coherence, purpose, and significance. Coherence is the belief that things kind of fit together, that things sort of happen for a reason. And, you know, there are some philosophies like absurdism and nihilism and existentialism that say that actually there is no purpose. I should say there is no coherence. Things don't happen for a reason. But most of us, we don't think that's true. We do think that things happen for a reason, because you look back in your life and you say, oh, that's why I had to deal with that thing. That's why that particular thing happened. That it kind of makes sense now. And so understanding that is key. The second is the purpose part itself, and where it's not just a synonym for meaning. Purpose is the idea that you have a direction you're going in, that you have goals. Purpose means, you know, I'm going toward that thing that really will bring me meaning. So, you know, I have the goal of being able to support myself and my family. I have the goal of doing something meaningful and helping other people. I have a goal of knowing God better than I currently do. I have a goal of getting to heaven. You know, that's a tremendous kind of purpose that brings a sense of meaning and ultimately happiness to people's lives. And the last is significance, which is simple. My life matters. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people who struggle with this. They say, I don't see how my life matters. And trauma of having a really bad childhood where your parents didn't make it clear that your life matters. The number one predictor of thinking your life matters is having mom and dad who said your life matters and who acted as if your life matters and who are like, I don't want you to drive above the speed limit or try drugs. And the reason is because you might hurt yourself and your life matters. that is hugely, hugely significant for actually predicting that. But when I talk to people and they say, I don't feel like I have meaning in life and it's hurting my happiness, I'll dig down to find which one of these three aspects of meaning is actually driving them crazy. Do they not, they think that, you know, things don't have any rhyme or reason? Do they have no goals? Or they not actually believe that their life matters? These are the three challenges.
And so what are ways of creating coherence?
You mean how things hang together?
Yeah, how things hang together. So for example, I'm one of those people, I would say, I'm not one of those people that believes like everything happens for the best or for a reason. Now, I have my own way of getting to coherence, but I'm kind of curious, what are ways of getting there if you don't sort of believe in that, like everything happens for a reason kind of mentality?
So when I say coherence, it doesn't necessarily mean there's a deterministic formula that's predestined to happen. There can be a lot of randomness in life. And my father was a statistician, his PhD in biostatistics, and he was a professor. And he used to say that God's greatest miracle is creating randomness in the universe. Mm. And he said, isn't it a wonderful thing, the distribution of events and the way that they can occur, and God chose to make things actually happen randomly. He says, what a wonderful miracle. He was a dedicated Christian all throughout his life. But he was like a, you know, nerd Christian, right? So you have this funny view of how this works, but there's nothing that's opposed to between the ideas of randomness and things happening following a distribution of events and happenstance, and believing that there actually is coherence. And the way to actually understand this is to say, okay, I don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen except God, but it might be random. Okay, fine. Going forward in your life. Now, let me look backward in my life. And so who are people who lack coherence and they feel like they're just kind of like jetsam being tossed about on the surf of life and it's making them intensely unhappy and uncomfortable. Write the narrative of your life. I mean, a lot of people end up trying to put meaning into their life by writing their own memoir, even if it's just a personal thing that you don't share with anybody. Mm-hmm. Try that. You know, try to write 5 pages of your memoir. I did this and I did this and I did this and this. And guess what? You're going to find coherence. You're going to find a through line. It may have happened relatively randomly, but you're going to find the meaning that is the thread that actually goes through it. So you look at your life, you don't necessarily believe that, that events are predestined, but you look at your childhood and your early adult life, and one thing led to another, and you built one thing on top of the last thing.
Yes.
Even including on the ashes of the stupid mistakes that you've made in your life. And on the basis of that, there is coherence. And that's a very important exercise for people to undertake.
Yeah, I think my approach to that is not everything happens for the best, but I can make the best out of everything that happens. You know, literally that, as you said, that there is a meaning that can be created out of the events that occur.
Yeah, the key thing to keep in mind is that, again, trouble finds us. And when trouble finds you, what I recommend that people do, somebody rejects you, somebody says something that's mean, somebody hurts your feelings, you didn't get that promotion, you didn't get that raise, you didn't get that job, you didn't get that person that you were in love with, et cetera. To actually look at the event, and instead of saying, that was a net loss, what a washout, my life would be way better if that happened a different way. Say, okay, it happened that way. I'm going to list the things that I learned from this. List the things you learned. And in doing that, you'll have a much firmer foundation upon which you can build on good and especially on bad things. And that's really important because when you do that, when one thing is built on another thing, including on bad things where you learned, that actually creates the coherence that you seek. You can actually write your own memoir as you're living your life. And that's really, really exciting. Furthermore, I'm telling you, when you take the bad feelings that are just existing in the limbic system of your lizard brain, and you write things down that you're learning, you're making them what we call in my business metacognitive, which is to say that you're bringing them to the prefrontal cortex of your brain and exposing your executive brain to these negative cognitions and finding the good that actually is in them and finding the ways you can profit from the experiences.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Let's talk about significance, because significance is one of those things that more and more I feel like our baseline of what we have to do in order for it to be significant seems to just be getting ratcheted up higher and higher. Some of this, I think, is social media comparison, although I want to circle around to you sort of saying like, hey, comparison is nothing new. It's bedeviled us for ages.
Yeah.
But I sometimes make the observation that if I look at my parents' life and what would have been considered a successful life for my parents versus a lot of younger people seems to be very different. Younger people seem to have more of a like, well, I need to raise great kids. I need to have a great career. I need to start an amazing charity. I need to do like 95 different things to be significant.
Right. There's a really important new book out by the physician and neuroscientist at Stanford named Anna Lemke, and it's about dopamine. And what she shows in that book is that you can get addicted to pretty much anything, because anything that actually stimulates you in any way, or you look forward to it, or you enjoy it, will give you a hit of dopamine. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter of pleasure and desire, and you'd produce it in the human brain so that you will encode experiences that you want to repeat. So when you do something that's kind of exciting or good, or, you know, I have great kids, I got a promotion at work, I had a really hardcore experience, or drugs and alcohol for that matter, you give yourself some dopamine and it puts you at a higher baseline for having to do it again, then again, and higher and higher and higher and higher. And this is the problem that we face in society today. The key to that is finding significance in the small. And this is a very deep philosophical and theological roots. And I'll give you an example of this. You know, Mick Jagger saying, I can't get no satisfaction, right? And the truth of the matter is that he could. The problem is he couldn't keep no satisfaction. You can get satisfaction, but only for a minute. The way to actually solve that and to find the significance of every moment without trying to have higher and higher and better and more followers and more money and more success. I mean, that's just a rat race, man.
Yeah.
Is to actually start being alive now and paying attention to the smaller things that should be providing the ultimate source of significance. And I'll give you an example of this. You know, I had this friend, man, he was a rat race kind of guy. This is a guy I worked with when I was in my 20s. So in my 20s, I didn't have a traditional career at all. I dropped out of college when I was 19 and I went on the road as a professional musician. And I was touring with these other four guys for a lot of my 20s. So I didn't go to college until I was in my late 20s. My parents called it my gap decade, kind of. And so I was working with this one guy. He was two decades older than I was. And he was just always about the next thing, always about the next gig. And just a very worried, anxious guy as a result of that, trying to find significance and always finding that it was elusive. I was in, you know, my late 20s at this time. He was in his late 40s. He gets this really bad cancer diagnosis. I mean, it was grim, man. The doctor's like, you need to make out your will. You got 6 months to live. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he went on some experimental drugs at the time and had a couple of miracles happen. And 6 months turned into a year, and a year turned into 2 years. And then it turned into 30 years. The doctor said, however, interestingly, this is a wolf at the door. So this is, you know, the one you feed is one thing. The wolf at the door is something else entirely. We're staying with the wolf theme today.
Yes, yes.
And he said, sooner or later, that wolf's going to slip in and it's going to kill you. I don't know if it's now. I don't know how many decades you're going to get or how many months you're going to get, but the wolf's going to get in sooner or later. So he lived like that. It was this incredible blessing to him.
Right.
And what did he do? He ratcheted everything down because he didn't know if he had a month. And so he ratcheted. And so I was visiting him. His life completely changed. It was like a different guy. And I was hanging out at his house. He was lived in Annapolis, Maryland. And we were hanging out at dusk one summer night with a bunch of friends. And we were hanging. It was great. And he says, hey, everybody, come here, come here, come here. It was just getting dusk. And he says, Christ, he was this flower, this bush that had flowers on it. And they were all closed, tight as a drum. And he said, watch the flower, watch the flower. And I said, what? He said, just watch the flower. And we're staring at these little closed flowers. And suddenly, they all opened. They all opened, just popped open at the same time. And we're like, we just gasped with this intense satisfaction.
And thinking about it now, I get satisfaction from it. Much, much more so than so many more exciting things on my hedonic treadmill, on my building the Tower of Babel all the way up into the sky, was actually go down, be alive now, go for a walk without your device. You know, it's interesting. It's really helped me. It's really changed my life. I spend a lot of time getting smaller now to actually find significance in my life. I'm a Catholic and I go to Mass every morning with my wife. It's the same thing every day.
Yep.
The same thing every day. And that's the point. You know, that's actually the significance that actually comes from the seemingly mundane. And in so doing, the significance of my life is actually more apparent to me than it's ever been.
Totally. It's what has drawn me to Zen as a path for me, because Zen is pretty obsessed on that very idea of like just the ordinary right now.
Right.
I mean, it's basically when Buddhism met Taoism, right? They sort of combined and made Zen. And so you get both those themes, but there is that almost near obsession with the small things of life.
Yeah. You know, the Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Theravada Buddhist monk, he has this famous book everybody should read called The Miracle of Mindfulness. It was very helpful to me in my life. And The Miracle of Mindfulness is basically, you know, we spend our lives thinking about the future so that we can ensure a good past. And in so doing, we miss the present. We're not actually, in a meaningful sense, we're not alive right now.
Yeah.
So he said, when you're washing the dishes, be washing the dishes. Wash each dish. And he walks through the process of washing dishes. You think it's really, really boring. It's actually riveting. And that's the critical thing for us to keep in mind. So many people are missing their lives, you know, and I hesitate to say turn off this great podcast, but if you want, turn off this podcast for 5 minutes.
What Arthur's saying is when you're done with this,
then be fully alive.
Yeah. Well, I love that Thich Nhat Hanh part where he talks about washing the dishes. I teach this in my spiritual habits program, because what he says is, you know, you're washing the dishes to get done so you can have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the cup of tea, but the problem is that if you don't know how to wash the dishes to wash the dishes, you don't know how to drink the cup of tea to have the cup of tea. And thus we are sucked moment by moment out of the present moment into the future, which has been my experience. I mean, it's one thing to miss like some of the more mundane things in life, but what I've found is that by missing the mundane, you've lost the ability to even appreciate the more beautiful things.
Yeah, for sure.
It's an inability to ever be here.
It becomes actually an unwillingness to be fully alive in the present. So it's a really interesting thing. So, you know, I talked to my class about the best way to have a vacation. How many pictures should you take? What should you do with the pictures? Mm. And inevitably, people do one of two things when they're taking pictures for a vacation. Either they're taking pictures so that they can enjoy their current vacation in the future when it is then the past. In other words, forget the current moment. Don't enjoy it now. Enjoy it later when you're thinking that it's the past. I mean, it's complete insanity.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, according to the data, decreases your pleasure of your vacation by 13%.
Hmm.
Or number two, where you're actually living it so that somebody who's not you can be envious and be enjoying your vacation, which is what you do when you're posting your pictures on social media, which according to the data lowers your pleasure in your vacation by 16%. It's a total loss to do this. And we're sleepwalking through life. This is what psychologists call prospection and retrospection. Prospection is living in the future. Retrospection in the past. And this is an incredible human trait. It's a miracle that we're able to do this.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that we make so much progress is that we can practice future scenarios that we've never lived by imagining them and living through them. The trouble is that we become so obsessed with living in the future and so comfortable doing it that our lives, they don't have significance in happening, that doesn't have any meaning. You know, what does it mean to be living in the future and then missing our current lives? You know, I know a lot of people who say, I feel like because I was planning for the future, working for the future, I missed my kids growing up. It's a very, very common lament. And it's just a specific case of this general problem that we're talking about now. So the average person is 30 to 50% of their time, literally 30 to 50% of their time living in the future. The average go-getter that's listening to us, like real entrepreneur, is 70 to 80% living in the future. We all need to dial that back so that we can be alive now.
Yeah, I certainly relate with that. I would probably put myself more in that 70 to 80% category. I've dialed it back and gotten better, but if I don't watch it, that's where I always am.
Oh yeah, totally. And you have a tendency.
Yep.
I mean, people will listen to us. They know who they are. You know who you are.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Let's change directions a little bit and talk about our fears about what other people think about us.
Yeah.
You've got a column recently titled, No One Cares.
Well, there's a huge problem that most people in our society have. Some people have it a little bit less. Some people have it a little bit more. Some people have this kind of a superpower of not caring, but most of us don't have that superpower. And we find that we think an awful lot about obsessing on what other people think of us. And it's interesting. Marcus Aurelius, the great Stoic philosopher, one time said that we love ourselves more than we love others, but we care more about other people's opinions of us than our own opinion about ourselves. What a great, irony that is.
Totally.
And it's so true. And so, you know, I wrote about that. I wrote about the deleterious phenomenon that worrying all the time about other people's opinions. And again, there's an evolutionary basis for this that's very, very clear. If you did not care what other people thought of you and you crossed the wrong lines in ancient society, you'd be thrown out into the frozen tundra without a tribe, without a community, and you would literally die. That's when the wolf would say, there's a tasty lunch. I want that one because it's alone. We have a hardwired tendency to care about what other people think of us and to want to curry favor with powerful people and indeed with the group. So if you want people on social media to like you and you want people who have a lot of social power to think favorably of you, that's why. It's your hardwiring that's making you do that, but it's extremely suboptimal and maladapted to our current circumstances. You know, we spend a ton of time trying to post fake versions of our lives on social media, which are depressing, disheartening. And by the way, they're depressing other people too, because we have an incredible incapacity to realize that everybody's posting a fake thing.
Yeah.
And we're the only ones who know that we're falsifying our life. It's just quite isolating, as a matter of fact. So there are ways to get around this. So if anybody's listening to us says, yeah, I'm spending too much time thinking about it, I just wish I could not care. Mm-hmm. There are ways to deal with this. So the first way to deal with this is, number one, is to realize that actually nobody cares. I mean, they might think less of you if they cared about you, but they're not thinking about you. And there's a ton of research that shows that people are thinking about you way, way, way less than you think they do. Even when they act like they're thinking about you, they're not thinking about you. They're only thinking about themselves. Me, 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 me. That's what people are actually doing. It's so freeing to realize that nobody cares. It's so incredibly freeing because they're like, oh, that's great. Nobody's looking at me. The second interesting way to do this is to think about how much we're judging other people. And we're judging other people constantly. You know, this is good. This is bad. That person's fat. That person's thin. That person's boring. That person's smart. That person's interesting. That person's stupid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when we're judging everything all the time, as opposed to observing things, and this, again, this is your practice Zen. So you know that the idea of observation is such a powerful tool as opposed to judgment.
Right.
But we're judging things all the time instead of observing them. And the result of that is that we're saying that it's legitimate for people to judge each other. You can judge each other. Go for it. Judge each other. That's saying you can judge me. And so the more you judge, the more you are open to the judgment of other people, and you will fall prey to the problem of caring about other people's opinions. So that's really important to keep it. Just don't judge. Just judge less. Take an hour and don't judge anything, and you'll feel unbelievably relieved. You won't know why. And the reason is just because it takes a lot of your energy, and you've opened the door to everybody else's judgment. So these are the two best tools. And then there are other things you can do about, you know, thinking about what actually embarrasses me about myself and I'm worried about being judged on. Do it. Go do it. Just go do it. I mean, and think about it. Think about the times that we've crossed the Rubicon. I tell a story in my column about giving a 3-hour lecture to my graduate seminar on the first day of class, and it turned out my fly was down the whole time, right? And there's 0% chance like my shirt was coming out of it. Or so it was just the worst. I mean, it was just really, really embarrassing. And I realized after that, it's like, man, that happened. And I didn't die. And it didn't matter, and nobody cares. And they laughed about it for sure. I'm sure there are students from that seminar that are still cracking up about that. And it's fine. And I felt kind of free, not free to do it again.
Right.
But
Right.
I felt free a little bit under those circumstances. So, you know, make a list of the things that you're kind of embarrassed about yourself and you think people might be laughing about you about. Make a list of them and then actually start laughing about them and introduce them into conversations in a self-deprecating way. You will be basically opening up your jail door.
Yeah. I love that idea. You have three different quotes around this, not judging others. Judge not that ye not be judged by Jesus. Whoever judges others digs a pit for themselves, the Buddha. And from the Tao Te Ching, care about people's approval and you'll be their prisoners. Three quotes I love. That is one of my favorite Tao Te Ching quotes of all time.
Yeah.
But it's so true. I've noticed that the less I have judged other people, the less I judge myself. And then the less I judge myself, the less I judge other people. It's a kind of a virtuous circle when I'm doing it in the right direction and a, you know, vicious spiral when I'm doing it in the wrong way.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And we all fall prey to it. So basically, the key to keep in mind is that when you're feeling really insecure about yourself, really bad about yourself, the reason is probably because you're judging other people too much. That's almost always the case. And in so doing, that you're exposing yourself to the judgment of others, where you're saying to yourself, come on, man, bring it on, judge me, just judge me, it's all good. That's the key thing to do. So anytime you feel insecure, the proper therapy is to stop judging and start observing, and to do that therapeutically for an hour, and your whole mindset will change.
Just a minute ago, you mentioned the humor aspect, right? The humor of teaching a class with your fly down, you know, the self-deprecating humor. Let's talk about the link between happiness and humor.
Yeah.
It's something we talk about on this show a lot. I've often said that I think levity is an underappreciated spiritual virtue. But talk about some of the things that may not be immediately intuitive to those of us who go, yeah, I think humor is a good way of increasing happiness. But you made some really interesting points in the column that were not immediately intuitive.
Yeah. So to begin with, when you say you have a sense of humor, or when somebody has a sense of humor, that means one of two things. Number one is that they appreciate funny things. And the second thing is that they make funny things. They both say he's got a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
Either he cracks up when you tell a joke or he cracks great jokes. Those are the two ways we talk about it. And they're very, very different phenomena. Happiness is associated with the first. It's not associated necessarily with the second. Funny people tend to be less happy than not funny people. Now, they tend to be more intelligent, but there's kind of a tortured spirit behind the naturally funny joke cracker. I'm sure that there are some comedians that are unbelievably happy people, but you find that clinical depression and even sociopathic tendencies tend to run heavier among professional comedians than other groups of people. And you notice the people who are funniest in your community, they don't laugh very much. The people who make the funniest jokes, they don't usually laugh at other people's jokes, and they don't laugh at their own jokes either. Notice this, and you'll start to see this pattern, as a matter of fact. On the other hand, people who laugh a lot at jokes, I mean, they just appreciate jokes, they tend to be much happier. And the great news is that you can cultivate that. There's some people who they have kind of a persona of being bummed a lot, and so they don't let themselves laugh. But if you basically give yourself permission, and this is actually something that you can do, you can, when you go to a new place, you can say, you know, I'm going to laugh at everybody's jokes more. Just literally saying that, what it does is it makes it once again metacognitive. It brings it to your consciousness, your prefrontal cortex of your brain, and you literally will start laughing at other people's jokes more and you will get happier. This is just, it's free, man. And it's something that we all should be able to do. It also is an incredible social lubricant. People will be like, I like him and I don't know why. And the reason is because he's cracking up all the time and I want to be around happy people. I want to be around people who laugh. It anesthetizes unpleasantness in a very real way. Not your jokes, but your laughter.
Yeah. You also make the point to avoid being grim. Reject grimness, you say. Is that sort of what you're saying there, is to decide sort of as a position to be less grim?
Yeah, and this gets political too, because, you know, our culture today, which is so unbelievably politically polarized, grimness is a weapon. Anytime you say that's not funny, you basically tried to take some power. You tried to grab some power. And that's one of the main ways our inability to take other people's jokes or to take offense when none was intended is a power move in our society today. And it transcends right-left distinctions. You actually find it across the political spectrum. This is key. And I'm sitting on a college campus and I see this all the time where, you know, you make a joke at your peril. Mm-hmm. And I understand, you know, stupid jokes or offensive jokes. And there are certain kinds of jokes that we should have moved beyond at this point in our society. And yet we haven't. But still, the key thing is, if you want to be happier, don't actually try to hurt people with jokes. But also don't take offense when none was intended by these jokes. And in so doing, you can be kind of in the anti-grimness, more levity part of the culture. Will you give up some political power? Yeah. Will you be happier? Yeah. Will you be making a happier culture? 100%.
Yep. I want to swing around briefly to the culture of contempt, but before we do, this is a time of the year that brings up a lot of unhappiness in people. Hmm. Some people love this time of year, but a lot of people don't.
Right.
I've been reflecting on the fact that there's a lot of expectation around the holidays, expectation that other people have on us, expectation we have on how the holidays should be. What would be a way to be happier through the holidays? What would be a way to deal with those expectations more wisely?
Well, to begin with, one of the main reasons that people are unhappy this time of year is because they're disappointed. And the reason they're disappointed is that we have a tendency to believe or to remember past holidays as better than they were. Mm. As I've called fading affect bias. It's a cognitive bias that we have where we remember the good parts of things and not the bad parts. Very, very common. It's a self-defense mechanism, but it's also because we learn from things and we keep getting benefit from the things we learned, and we jettison the parts of our memories that are not useful to us. Like, you know, Uncle Mike got, you know, loaded and, you know, passed out in the front yard after screaming obscenities at the neighbors on Christmas Day. You know, that kind of thing, is we leave that behind. So we tend to be disappointed when our holidays don't live up to either our expectations about the future, which tend to be very rosy, or our memories, our nostalgic memories from the past. That's a key thing. The second big problem that we have is that we feel there's a lot of pressure. You know, we feel a lot of pressure to sing the Christmas carols and to enjoy the holidays. And for some people, it's really, really hard. I remember this was very hard for my mom. My mom, you know, she suffered a lot, very ill for almost all of my childhood. And she would suffer on the holidays, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas. They were really, really, really hard for her. And the main reason is because she felt there was an expectation for her to be the perfect mother and the perfect cook and have the perfect home. And she didn't feel she was up to it. That was a problem. So what do we do? You know, for those of our listeners who they suffer a little bit on the holidays, number one is reject the expectations and do your own thing. You know, if you find the consumerism really off-putting, then put together a Christmas with people where who are like you, and you decide you're not going to spend money. As a matter of fact, don't spend any money from any consumer money from Thanksgiving through January 1st. It should be a rebel. Be countercultural, man. And you'll be amazed at actually how happy it makes you by being countercultural per se and being around people who do that. Or, you know, when my kids were little, my wife, who's from Spain, she often, because the kids would be home, she would take one kid and go see her mother in Barcelona over Thanksgiving. And I would have the other, our other two kids. And she's like, oh, it's going to be so sad. And the first year I took them to a restaurant and then to the movies. And it became this tradition where I had two kids and they were competing to be the ones who were home to go to the restaurant and the movies with dad. And it was like, and you'd see me with my kids. I look like a divorced dad who got you know, custody of his kids on Thanksgiving. And it was too pathetic to make a turkey or something. We were having this great old time. Make your own traditions is the key thing. And then the third thing is leave the memories behind. Leave your expectations behind. Just today's Christmas. Today's Thanksgiving. Let it be what it is. Let it be what it is. And finally, actually, one more. Don't talk politics. Don't talk politics on the holidays, because you're going to get politics in the way of your love, and your love is more important than politics.
Ah.
And that leads to your last question, doesn't it?
It does. And I'm going to actually bring that back on you a little bit, because you summarized your whole book on the culture of contempt to a few lessons, and you then said it even simpler. Go find someone with whom you disagree, listen thoughtfully, and treat them with respect or love.
Yeah.
A lot of times, for many of us, unfortunately, sometimes maybe the only time we encounter somebody who believes something different than us is when we're forced into our families of origin.
Yeah.
But you're saying if you want the holidays to be good, then is not the time to try and take on the culture of contempt. Leave that for another time.
Yeah, generally speaking, that's a good idea. That doesn't mean you have to avoid it.
Yeah.
It just means that don't be going and looking for it. Don't say, you know, there's the Democratic Party and the Republican Party both have, in different parts of these parties, have put out a guide to how to beat your family in arguments, which is actually evil.
Yeah.
You know, this is evil to giving people a guide on how they can vanquish their family members. And, you know, Dale Carnegie, the great self-improvement writer, one time said that a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still.
Yes.
Even if you win the argument, you lose the argument, because nobody in history has ever been insulted into agreement. This is really, really important thing to keep in mind. So go rushing toward the people with whom you agree. Listen to them with civility and love, and not just tolerance, with actual love. Then on Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, talk about the things that matter first, which is, you know, the people that you have in common, the love that you have for each other, the fun things that you've done over the course of the year. And you probably won't even get to the politics by the end of the day, but you'll say, you know, my crazy Republican Aunt Marge, you know, we love the same things. And that's what really matters.
Well, that is a beautiful place to wrap up. I would love to get more into contempt and talk about what it is and all the problems. Your greatest book is wonderful. Maybe that'll be another time.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been a real pleasure to talk with you. And thanks for sharing so much of your wisdom with us.
You have a great show and you're doing a lot of good. And I appreciate it a lot being able to be some small part of it.
Thank you.
Right on.
If what you just heard was helpful to you, please consider making a monthly donation to support the One You Feed podcast. When you join our membership community with this monthly pledge, you get lots of exclusive members-only benefits. It's our way of saying thank you for your support. Now, we are so grateful for the members of our community. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without their support, and we don't take a single dollar for granted. To learn more, make a donation at any level and become a member of the One You Feed community, go to oneyoufeed.net/join. The One You Feed podcast would like to sincerely thank our sponsors for supporting the show.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.